The views expressed on this podcast are only those of the individuals featured on the show and do not in any way reflect the official policy of the United States government.
You are listening to the Embassy Wealth Podcast. We believe wealth isn't just about finances and money. It includes health, relationships, and anything else that makes you excited to get up in the morning. We interview members of the foreign affairs community to see how they're building wealth, both personally and financially, no matter where they're posted. This is your host, Tanya Salsa. Let's get to today's show. Welcome to the Embassy Wealth Podcast. I am super excited to introduce our guest today, Joe Burkhead. Joe Burkhead is from Willisburg, Kentucky. He joined the Marine Corps after graduating high school and was in the Marine Corps for 8 years as a radio operator for an artillery unit in Hawaii. And then he did the MSG program in Paris, in Kiev, Tokyo, and Canberra before joining the Department of State in 2008 as a diplomatic security agent. And since then, he's been on assignments in New Hampshire, India, Pakistan, Russia, and he's joining us today from Seattle, Washington. And one of the reasons I'm super excited about talking to Joe today is actually we met through the Foreign Service Real Estate Investors Facebook page because 2 years ago in February 2019, I recall this very distinctly, he casually posted, "Oh yeah, and I have 70 properties." And I thought, what? How on earth does he have 70 properties? And I didn't know Joe at the time, but he looked very young. And I thought, how on earth has he gotten 70 properties? So he is here today to tell us how he started buying rental property in 2002 at the age of 23 and now has 90 units in central Kentucky and a small hobby farm for breeding registered Scottish Highland cattle. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here today, Tanya. I really appreciate you guys inviting me to attend your podcast. I will say that this is the first time that I've ever participated in a podcast, but hopefully it will not be a complete failure.
Yeah, it's incredible. I was blown away 2 years ago. And 2 years ago when we spoke, I think you said you had 70 and now you have 90. So tell us how that all started. Tell us a little bit about your investment story.
So some of my bio already kind of lays out how it all started, but I grew up in central Kentucky in a small farming community. As you stated earlier, the name of it's Willisburg. Current population is still less than 400. And while there, I worked, I would say, like pretty hard jobs that didn't pay anything. As a high school student in central Kentucky, back in mid-90s, most folks that I grew up with normally had farm jobs or they would work at restaurants, fast foods, or something like that to try and earn some money. But I think that those jobs built character and they really made me appreciate what few things I could afford to buy for myself as a high school student. So as you stated, I joined the Marine Corps right after high school. Basically about 2 months after I graduated, I shipped off to Parris Island, South Carolina for a number of reasons, but a free education was pretty high on the list. Since I didn't have to repay any student loans or cover my rent while active duty, I started researching investment options. And I'll be honest, I wasn't extremely impressed with the stock market or its limited tax advantages or what I understood them to be. So I started reading about real estate investments. So the year was 2001. I was 22 years old, sitting in Paris, France at my first assignment on the Marine Security Guard program. And I stumbled upon the Rich Dad, Poor Dad series. I think a lot of folks have heard of those, but the author's name is Richard Kiyosaki. I probably botched his name, but in any case, it's the Rich Dad, Poor Dad series. I felt like his examples in the books, a lot of them were very repetitive and his story seemed a bit fictitious to me, but I think that he explained things at a very rudimentary level. And a lot of his principles revolved around just a few things: time value of money, using the bank's money for leverage, and using real estate as an investment vehicle to obtain financial independence. So I used that information and what little bit of information I could get from others. So I'll just say that I don't come from a family of real estate investors. In fact, whenever I mentioned the idea of wanting to buy my first rental property, My father told me that I should probably just take my money and put it in a savings account. That's the mindset that he had. And he was a very low stress individual. Like, he didn't want to be bothered with dealing with tenants and contractors and stuff like this. So the other side of this coin is I still had another two assignments left on the MSG program. So I had asked whether or not he could help manage that rental property if I bought one until I got out of the Marine Corps, I guess probably 3 years later. And initially he was opposed to it, but then after a little more discussion and consideration, he changed his mind. So when I left Paris, in between that assignment and my next, in 2002, I purchased my first multifamily home. This is a two-story fourplex apartment building located in Lawrenceburg, Kentucky. And this property was no longer listed on the market. In fact, I wasn't having much luck finding anything that was for sale, but a realtor had known about this property that had been on the market, but the listing expired and it wasn't on the market anymore. So he approached the seller, and the individual ended up selling to me. So I had good credit at, you know, 22 years old, but mortgage companies weren't giving me a lot of love as a 22-year-old Marine trying to obtain a $200,000 loan. But after speaking to several loan officers, I finally found one. And then I brought a $30,000 down payment to the closing table. This is basically the money that I was able to save during my first year on the MSG program, and then what little bit of money I had saved before that out in Hawaii. And then they in turn gave me a 30-year fixed loan at 7.75%. This was back in 2002. So, wow. So when I started the process, I was 22 years old. And then by the time I finally closed on it, I had turned 23. My birthday had been like a month earlier. And then after buying the property, I refinanced it a year later for 6.5%. I mean, at that point, I had established maybe my credit a little bit stronger, and I found a different bank that was willing to let me buy a couple points and basically secure a lower interest rate for that same property. Meanwhile, I kept saving my money on the MSG program, and I finally bought a second property in 2006. This was after I got off the program and was out of the Marine Corps. And this was four years later, at 26 years old, 4 years after I purchased the first property. And this was a duplex in Lexington, Kentucky. So from 2006 to now, I've been fortunate enough to increase that portfolio from 6 units to 90. And as Tanya said, she spoke to me a couple years ago and it was around 70. But there were years when I didn't find a single property to buy. And then there were other years when I purchased 5 duplexes in a single year. And that's what's happened over the past couple years. I managed to find several properties in the same calendar year to buy. But the thing with these rental properties is I've always been very selective of the stuff that I buy. I never really pursued single family homes because the return on those was always less, at least in my market, than the multifamilies. And I also avoided properties that needed a lot of work just because I wasn't home to work on them and babysit them. It just seemed a lot easier to find properties that basically needed some new flooring and a paint job and maybe just a few items fixed, but I was not interested in rehab projects. So I've walked away from more properties than I've purchased over the years. I would say that I've probably walked away from 5 properties for every one that I bought. And in most of those cases, I actually paid for home inspections and termite inspection properties and was out of pocket before I decided not to proceed with the purchase. But when I first started buying these properties, I made a very simple rule for myself. I said that I would never buy a property that I wouldn't be willing to live in myself. Now, obviously, if I buy the property and it needs like new flooring, well, you know, I'll do what it needs to make it nice and habitable and presentable. But I always avoided like rough neighborhoods and junk properties. predominantly because I didn't want my tenants to have to live in that. I didn't want to have a reputation as a slumlord. And then also because my mother helps manage all these properties, I did not want to expose her to those issues. So most of my properties are duplexes. The other thing with these rental properties is I joined the Department of State in 2008, and I actually delayed buying my first primary residence until 2014. So for all those years of buying rental property, I never had a single family home, which was my home. Like when I would go home on vacation, I would stay with my parents at their house. I never really had a place I could call home until 2014. So I used all of my disposable income from 2002 until 2014 as down payment money for more rental properties.
I know. It's an incredible story, right? Right?
Well, it's actually worked out really well because over time, the interest rates have improved, as you guys have seen yourself. So in my situation, I was able to buy stuff that cash flowed at such high interest rates. And obviously, the purchase prices were much lower than, like, as the, I think now the market we're seeing now, like, the purchase prices are pretty high, one, because there's not a lot of inventory, but also because the interest rates are so low. It's driven the prices up. So in my case, I was able to buy properties at a lower price point at a higher interest rate, but my principal balance didn't change over time. What did change was my interest rate. So in fact, I have a lower monthly payment now on some of those properties that I was able to refinance than what I did when I bought them. But my expenses have really gone down. And in fact, my rent rates have gone up too. So if it worked then, it works even better now.
Yeah, it definitely works now. I'm curious, Joe, because 90 units is an incredible amount of property to finance, right? And so when you got to the limit, and I'm not sure what the limit was back then, because at some point, they said, you know, 10 conventional loans for Fannie and Freddie, right? So at what point did you stop getting the 30-year conventional fixed? And then how did you transition to that? And essentially, what kind of bank are you working with? Are you working with like a local credit union? I mean, who's financing your properties for you?
Sure. So when I first started buying these, and I think you hit on it already, like the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac rules were 10 properties was the max that they would government back. Right. So, when I first started buying them, it was 10. And then in 2008, I was actually on my 10th property. I was in the process of buying my 10th property. Now, keep in mind, 90 units is not 90 separate structures. A duplex encompasses two separate units under that same roof. So that duplex is considered one property. So on my 10th property, I was in the process of closing, but everything wasn't locked in yet. They changed that cap from 10 until 4, I think is what it ended up being. You said that you thought the cap was still 10.
It's gone back to 10.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So during the 2008 period, they lowered that from 10 to 4. So I kind of got caught in a predicament where I was ready to close. And at the very last minute, they pulled the rug out from underneath of my feet had to find a new lender. So what I did is I reverted to hometown banks, so like the local banks that you see in your hometown that aren't Bank of America, that aren't Chase. I think they call them secondary markets. So what happened was I basically found a local bank that was willing to finance the property. And what you get from a local bank that you can't get from the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, the government backed mortgages are a couple things. One, they have less guidelines to follow. The bank does have some guidelines that they have to follow, but they're not as hard and fast as the government standards. But then the other thing is you don't get a 30-year fixed. In fact, the best I can get is a 5-year adjustable rate mortgage. So, but with the 5-year mortgage, as we've seen, the rates have gone down over time. So it never was really an issue for me because I didn't get, it really wasn't an issue for me because I wasn't in a situation where my payment went up drastically because the interest rates increased. So when we talk about the local banks, right now, my portfolio is basically spread amongst two hometown banks. Both of them are in Kentucky. And because they still have to go in front of a bank board to approve my loans, but it's very streamlined. At this point, they've got my, basically my whole portfolio is there on an Excel spreadsheet. So they kind of know how everything performs. And what I'll do is update that on an annual basis with a new, basically cash flow sheet, my rent rows, and then my accounting statement along with my tax return every year. And so to answer your question, I'm utilizing local banks. So with the local banks, the ones I'm using, those are 85% loan to value. So I have to come to the closing table with 15% down payment. One of the banks allows me to amortize the loans over 20 years. The other one is at 25 years. I would say that this whole real estate investment thing started out with my father helping me manage them while I was away. When I got back, whenever I got out of the Marine Corps and moved back home, I took over the management myself, which was a really good experience because I don't think that you really understand what goes on with managing rental property until you do it yourself. 100%. It's easy enough to pay a property manager whatever it is they want to charge you, and like you never get the phone calls, you don't hear all of the complaints and things that people manage to raise over time. But so I came home, I managed those that fourplex that I had for about a year, and then I left and went overseas to do some contract work for State Department. And I understood that my father wanted no part of managing them again, and I quite honestly didn't want to
ask blame
him.
Your father, Joe. No offense.
Right. So what I did is I found a property management company in Lexington and had them manage it for me. I will say that it turned into a complete disaster, despite the reviews they had on their website. I was a very, very small client for them. They were used to managing properties for people probably similar to where I'm at now. So for someone who had just a handful of properties, I was very low on the priority list for them. I mean, I was paying them 10%, just like the guy who had 80 units was paying them 10%. But I didn't get their time and attention when it came to issues. I was always basically blindsided by issues. The biggest issue being like tenants not paying their rent on time. So it'd be the middle of the month and I hadn't received my rent payment deposited into my account yet. But all of my loans were set up on auto payment. So I'll just backtrack and say that at this point, I'd also acquired that duplex in Lexington. So,
I'm sorry, you have 6 units at this point that you turned over to property management?
Yes. Okay. So, just one point here. So my uncle, he managed the fourplex for me because he lived in Lawrenceburg. And then, basically we swapped time before I left the US to go do the contract work. I helped him work on some of his rental properties. And basically the agreement was, hey, I'll help you work on your properties for the next few months. I don't want you to pay me anything for it, but in turn, if you could help manage my fourplex for the next year while I'm overseas, we'll just call it even. And that was the agreement we had on the fourplex. The property management place managed the duplex in Lexington because it was the next town over. I thought it would be easier them being co-located in the same city with the property. So the property management thing did not go very well. We had a 1-year agreement. After 9 months, I told them, I don't care what I have to pay you to get out of this. I don't want you managing my property anymore. And then I worked out a deal for my uncle to take over management of that property. So the thing that we'll talk about later is basically setting up the resources to help manage your properties. If you're doing so, kind of like my situation now, where you're not in the same city with your properties and you're having to rely on someone else to kind of safeguard them and make sure everything's taken care of in your absence. So what was happening with the rental property company is the tenant would call and complain to them about anything and everything. In one instance, I got a bill for the dishwasher that was making noise. Well, they sent their contractor out there to investigate the noisy dishwasher who couldn't find anything wrong with it, but they sent me a bill for $80. But that same tenant didn't pay their rent on time, and they refused to charge late fees for the tenant. This tenant habitually paid their late rent, but I never got a single penny of late fees from them. So I think that was the straw that broke the camel's back. But I digress. So about scaling the properties and basically growing my portfolio and managing them. So I scaled my portfolio to the size that it is now by exercising a number of different things. One, I kept a really close eye on my expenses, and I still do that now. I shop around for the best deals on everything from appliances to materials to contractors. And I promptly address any late rent situations. When I first started, and I think this may happen with a lot of landlords, even if they're not the ones managing them, the properties themselves, is they have a tendency to want to work with tenants, especially if they don't have a lot of properties, because they're afraid of a situation where their property may sit empty. So they really want to try and work with the tenant and keep them there and figure out a way to catch the tenant up on their rent payments and make everything right. But my experience is it just doesn't ever work out very often that way. In fact, once the tenant's beyond a month late on their rent, they've already exhausted their 1 month security deposit. And then from there, every day that they don't pay, you're upside down on your leverage. So I got burned a couple times. And from there, I just said, whether or not the place sits empty or not, I'm just not going to allow a situation where a tenant stays there any longer than authorized by law without being evicted. If they don't have the money to pay their rent, then they can move in with a family member, or they can borrow the money from someone else or what, but I'm just not going to be the one that's paying their rent or covering their rent until they can come up with the money. So I've followed that from basically a very early point in this rental property business, and it's always been the best bet. And in fact, whenever you put your foot down from the get-go, or your property manager does, and explains to them you will pay late fees and all this stuff spelled out in your lease, then I think they know that you're not the weak link. You're not the low-hanging fruit when they're looking for places to defer payments. In some cases, like when I first started out and I was trying to work with these tenants who couldn't pay their rent, they'd have pizza boxes stacked up outside their door. These are the same people that had like brand new cell phones, but they were the same tenants who didn't want to pay their rent on time because they said they didn't have it. So once we adopted this like very strict policy about enforcing late fees and requiring tenants to pay on time every month, and a lot of that problem went away. And in fact, with as many properties as we have, like, it's very rare that we have to evict someone. Just they know where we stand going in to the lease agreement, and they just know that we're a no-nonsense operation. Like, we're very firm, we're very fair, but we're not going to cover the rent for them. If they don't have the rent money, then they need to come up with another option or to pay their bills or move out. It's that simple. But as time went on and I was able to create equity just over time, the mortgage payments paid down my principal, I started utilizing cash out refinances to access available equity from those properties that I'd owned for a while in order to buy additional properties using that money for down payment money. This isn't like something that's been real easy for me to do because I couldn't find very many banks that were willing to do it. In fact, a lot of the banks haven't gone through the issues they experienced in 2008, like took a much greater the conservative approach to lending money, and a lot of them just didn't want to do that. But I have found one bank that's been very generous. But as I mentioned before, I'm very selective with the properties that I buy. So I want to believe that helps my cause when I go to them and ask for a cash out refinance, because they know that I'm not going to take that money and buy junk properties and stuff that just isn't a good place to park my money, which is, in fact, majority of it's their money too. So, yeah. And just one other thing here for scaling my portfolio. So I went through an extended period of time in which there were very few properties that were available on the market. Like, typically what I'm seeing now in my local market in Kentucky are properties that folks are sitting on that need a lot of work done to them, but they're taking advantage of the local conditions or the current conditions in order to offload those properties maybe that need a new roof or just have been really neglected over the course of several years. But the market's so strong that they're able to sell that property at a really premium price, whereas a few years ago, it would have been really hard for them to get rid of that. So what I decided to do was build some new construction duplexes. And it seemed like a pretty good idea at the time. But last year, I broke ground on construction, like summer time frame, had the footers poured and started with the foundation. And then the price of materials went through the roof. And I think they're still quite high compared to what they were 18 months ago. But I started building three duplexes, and two of them are almost finished. One of them we hope to start renting in the next couple of weeks. On the third one, after we poured the footer, I just decided to hold off on it until the cost of material came down a little bit. But that's kind of where I'm at now, is looking for good deals that are really hard to find, and then waiting for the cost of material to possibly come down after some time, and maybe try and build some more.
Okay, Joe, I think you just blew my head off. I mean, talk about a way to pivot. It's like, well, if the market isn't giving you what you want, oh, I'll just go build it. And in the meantime, I mean, you're essentially overseas, right? Like for this whole period where you weren't back in Kentucky, right? During any of this how do you do that when you are essentially not in the spot where you're constructing your empire, right? And I guess a follow-on question to that was, when you started, right, when you bought that first fourplex, which, by the way, I'm already impressed, because I think most people would say, oh, I don't want to start with four. That's just too much, right? And I think you were very focused after, you know, reading Rich Dad Poor Dad and saying, this is the way I'm going to do it. When you first started, right, did you have this idea that you were going to have this 90 unit empire? I mean, like, what was your idea at the beginning? How did it morph? I know that's a very long question, but I'm so fascinated. So please tell us.
Yeah. So I'll answer the first part of your question first. You ask, like, how do you do this remotely? And I'll be very honest with you. The only way that I think I've been able to do it is via the support and help from my family. So, I have an uncle whom is my mother's brother. He had a few rental properties, and he still does have a few, but he has built several houses for himself. So he has a knowledge of construction, and he's semi-retired. So when I mentioned the idea of building those duplexes, he told me that he would just oversee the construction for me. And I thought that meant going there and checking on the progress and making sure that the quality control was there and that there were no shady things going on behind the drywall. But I should have known better, because he is a workaholic, and he's like, there is no, how to say it. He's an overachiever. So, he's actually, on most days, and the contractors even told me this, he'd be out there at the job site before the contractor would show up to work. I mean, just going over everything, looking, sweeping up, picking up trash. But I think the only way that I felt comfortable building those duplexes is because he was there to help oversee those. I understand everyone doesn't have that luxury. But that was my
It's your secret weapon.
He was the reason.
Or not so secret.
He was He was the reason I felt comfortable doing it. But there are like competent general contractors that I could hire to do the work. And I may still end up doing that at some point. But as a first time building duplexes from scratch, this was something, this was an arrangement that gave me the confidence to move forward. So the second part of your question you asked, like, where did I see this going when I started out? I'll be quite honest with you. I didn't really think about where I wanted to go. And I still don't, as far as like how big I want this to be. At this point, it's just really about like taking care of the people that are working for me. So my mother, she quit her full-time job to take over the management of this rental property stuff. So I like the idea of giving her enough work to keep her gainfully employed. And in most days, I think she's overemployed. I think she could use a break. So I did find another woman who's been helping us for a couple years now as basically an assistant property manager. So this allows my mom to take vacation. She's been out here to visit me a couple times in Seattle. But I have some continuity for the administrative side of the house now, having a second person there that's there in the same proximity of the properties to help keep an eye on things if my mom wants to take a break. But I still don't really have a ceiling on the number of properties that I want. I will say that I've been looking at vacation homes as a place to park my money. I've been looking at stuff down in Florida. I've been looking at stuff out of Montana. Just because I feel like if I'm not careful, I'll spend all of my time and energy putting like my money into rental properties and not really enjoying life to its fullest. So I've tried to take a different approach to this real estate investment stuff, to look at stuff that would also give back to me and my family in the way of like vacation time. So I don't know when I'll stop buying, but I do know that I have another 8 years left with State Department. I'll be 42 this year and I can retire at 50. But I feel like my mom, even though she's really still pretty young, I feel like she's going to wake up one day and decide that she doesn't want to be bothered with this stuff anymore. So at that point, I'll need to find another really, really competent person to help manage that stuff until I can retire and come home and be bothered with some of the headaches myself. Yeah, I really think it's worth mentioning because I think people can be illusioned by the idea of these 90 properties, but I think we also have to keep in mind the cost of real estate in Central Kentucky compared to other areas throughout the U.S. Where like here I can, well, I say here in Kentucky, I can buy a duplex for somewhere between $150,000 and $175,000. And this is a duplex that doesn't need very much work. It's ready to rent, might need some paint or something like that. But there are very few places, you know, outside of Kentucky where you can buy multifamilies for that price point. So I don't think it's really fair to compare me to someone who may have only a small fraction of the portfolio that I have, because they're having to pay a lot more money for their property. So you can only stretch your down payment money so far. But I think the whole real estate model, it doesn't matter where you're at. It's all kind of the same. As long as you're buying properties that have positive cash flow, you're smart with your money, and you keep leveraging your equity to grow your portfolio, then I think as long as you find a market where you can buy properties that cash flow, I think anybody could copy paste the same model anywhere. So I actually have a few pieces of advice, because there's not any one like main piece of advice I could give, and they're in no particular order. So I would say the first thing is like, don't delay the decision to buy. If you know that you want to put your money into real estate as opposed to the stock market or something else, like I recommend that you get pre-approved for a loan immediately. And whenever you go to place an offer, like that is a huge plus, is to have a pre-approval letter that's basically your assurance that you're good for the loan. Find an area that you like and locate the resources to manage your properties. Like before you ever go to the table to buy a property, it's nice to have all that homework kind of laid out beforehand. Because and I say like don't delay the decision to buy, because the main, I think, benefit of buying and owning real estate is the time value of money is allowing your tenants to help pay your principal down. So the longer you hold that property, especially if it cash flows, the more money you're going to get off the property, but then the longer you've had for that, that principal to be paid down, to eventually be paid off, or to, as I mentioned earlier, to borrow against your equity if you want to buy more properties. Another point is like never buy a property that doesn't cash flow if you have a choice. I hear people like talking about buying properties that don't cash flow, and I just do not understand that at all. The property should strengthen your property and help build cash reserves to assist with purchasing your next property. It doesn't make sense to me to buy a rental property that loses money every month unless it's your home and you converted it to a rental property. In some cases, a single family home is hard to cash flow just because the numbers just don't work out the same as multifamilies. But even then, if you're in a scenario where you have your primary residence that you're trying to convert to rental property, you might even decide it's better to just sell the property and walk away with the cash to buy something else that does cash flow, as opposed to losing money each month on that property that doesn't cash flow. And if you are in a market or you're looking at a market where none of the properties that you can find cash flow, then I think you really need to find a different market where that's possible. For me, I've been blessed. Kentucky, the area that I'm in, if you find a rental property, it's a given. It's going to cash flow unless there's something really, really strange going on. And if I'm able to cash flow at 15% down, like some cases you may have to put a little more money down for it to cash flow. But at the end of the day, you want cash flow to be able to pay for the maintenance on that property, but then also to help you build a cash reserve to grow your business, if that's your objective, to grow your business bigger. The next point I would say is don't give up. If you aren't getting the answer you want from a lender, as my case, I mean, I had a tough time finding folks to lend me money when I first started out because I was young. I didn't have any experience with rental property. I was maybe a higher risk client for them. Shop for other lenders who want your business. There are lenders out there who will work with you. If you don't get the answer from the first couple of places that you visit, don't give up. Just keep going. The next point is always do your homework before buying the property. I always recommend getting inspected by a reputable home and termite inspector, even if you think there are no issues with the property. You just don't want there to be any issues after you buy with regard to foundation work or the seal plates are eat up with termites, stuff that is going to run into a lot of money. It's better to know that going into it. At least you can make a well-informed decision about whether or not you're making the right decision to buy. Get your insurance quotes up front. Make sure that you do a search to make sure the property is not in a flood zone, especially if you're looking at for sell by owner properties where maybe there's maybe more of an issue with stuff being disclosed. Most of the time when you're dealing with a realtor, a lot of that stuff is disclosed. They've got a seller's disclosure form they use. But if you're buying stuff from an individual, a lot of times some of that stuff might not be transparent and you just don't want any surprises. But with, for example, a property being in a flood zone, most lenders, if not all of them, will require you to carry flood insurance policy on that property. And it's really, really costly. But these are the kind of things that you want to know about when you go into buying the property, as opposed to after you buy it, or at least you're committed to a bunch of expenses with inspections and title work and all that before you get surprised with these other issues. The other thing is a lot of times you'll see, or I see listings that have rental property for sale, but the rent rates they're advertising that the listing agents basically noted on the listing, they're either inaccurate or they may be a little bit unrealistic. So I always recommend, like, if you don't know the area and it's not an area that you're already invested in, like, do your own research, independent research, to try and get an idea of what the rent rates are for that area. And the easiest thing to do is just go to like Zillow and see what the places in that area are renting for. You can get an idea of the size and condition of the property to let you know whether or not you're somewhere in the ballpark of what your place will rent for. But it would be really unfortunate to think that you're going to get an extra few hundred dollars rent on your property based off of maybe inaccurate information, only to find out after you buy it and you get the thing rented, if it wasn't occupied already, that your property doesn't cash flow. And then something that's always helpful that may not be obvious is if the property is occupied, it's really helpful if you can talk to the current tenants who reside there already and see if they're aware of any issues, because sometimes they'll be very honest with you, especially if they don't want to move and there's some issue because they'd like to have it fixed, but it might not show up on the seller's disclosure, or if it's for sale by owner, it may have not been disclosed to you at all. So in a few cases, I've found that the tenants were really helpful in advising me about issues, even if it was about the neighborhood. Maybe the property that they're living in is fine, but oh yeah, this, two blocks or, two houses down, like, we've had issues with gunshots there, stuff that you just don't want any part of if you can avoid it. And the last point that I would say is always network. So I think that doesn't matter what you're doing in life, it's always beneficial to network with people who share common interests, because there'll be times whenever you might learn something from that individual, or in the case of real estate, I've actually had deals come to me via network, and someone found out about properties that were for sale and told me about them because they knew I was looking for something to buy. So I think that you can never underestimate the value of networking.
I was also curious about how to spend your money and how to invest it. So you had $30,000 when you started out. So obviously you did something right in 2002 when you started in budgeting wisely and building that nest egg that you then deploy and start your empire. What kind of financial advice do you have for your peers who are looking into getting into investing?
Sure. That's a really good question. I think that I'm maybe more of a unicorn than most folks that may be interested in trying to start out investing in real estate. With regard to, I didn't have a family, I didn't have kids, and I'm not saying that you can't do that with a family and kids, but I made a lot of sacrifices that I probably wouldn't have done if I wasn't making the decisions just for myself. So I mentioned earlier that I didn't have a home until, I didn't have my primary residence until much later in life, but just to accumulate the money that I had for that first down payment, I really was self-conscious about my spending. I didn't buy stuff that I didn't need. There were a lot of things that I wanted to buy, but I instead would sit on the decision for a couple, 3 days to make sure that I really wanted to buy it. In most cases, after thinking about it a little while, I decided just to postpone the purchase. But in my case, I started out with a fourplex property at around $220,000 purchase point. But I could have started out with a much smaller property if I couldn't afford it. So I could have looked at a duplex. I could have looked at a single family home that cash flowed. So I think to answer your question, folks just have to know, like, what is a realistic budget for them to be able to save money and to accumulate enough for that first down payment. And then from there, pursue that first purchase. And then from there, I think everything just kind of falls into place over time.
Well, Joe, that leads us to the end of our show. And I mean, frankly, I think we could keep talking here for several more hours because, I mean, you've got 19 years of real estate investing experience and a lot more to share with our listeners. How can people get in touch with you if they want to reach out?
Sure. I can have you add my email address to the site there for the podcast, but then also folks can find me on Facebook. I have a an active profile there. My business also has a Facebook page as well. It's Burkhead Realty Holdings LLC, and I'll let you include that name on your link as well if folks wanted to reach out to me for any questions. And I really like the idea of networking, so perhaps they can enlighten me along the way as well. I'm always interested in learning new things from different people. Well, thanks so much, Tanya. I appreciate your time, and I look forward to hearing the final product of our webcast today, as well as any subsequent podcasts that you guys are able to generate. I think this is a really good program, and I'm happy to be part of it.
Thanks, Joe.
If you like this episode and want more, make sure to give us 5 stars on the podcast player of your choice. And after that, check out our Facebook page. From there, you can learn about our other episodes, connect with our guests, and of course, share your own ideas for success. We'll see you next time.